RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Perhaps some of the more senior listeners might recall a television commercial in the 1980s, where a man holding an electric razor was so impressed with the product that he declared he'd bought the company that made it. Back in 2008, my guest today was so passionate about the magazine he worked for, well, you guessed it, he bought the magazine. That magazine is I, described as the world's most beautiful and collectible graphic design journal. And the man who maintains those high standards is the Royal Designer Simon Esterson, who is one of Britain's most outstanding book and editorial designers. Over the last four decades, he has art directed a raft of publications, including Designer's Journal, Architectural Review, Blueprint, the RA, The Guardian G2, Domes, The New Statesman, and many international publications before he settled down as joint owner and publisher of I Magazine. When asked by students for advice, there is one piece I will always give. Try to seek out clients in areas that you have a passion for, because you'll give those projects your all and more. What is fascinating about this interview is it reveals from a very young age Simon's relentless curiosity and burgeoning fascination with print. From that moment, the die was cast for his future career. I hooked up with Simon remotely, with me in Dorset, while Storm Franklin was raging outside. This, on reflection, is highly appropriate because Franklin is also the name of a typeface that Simon has great affection for. Meanwhile, he was sitting in I's North London offices. You've had a long career, there's no doubt about that now. And I suppose these days you're mostly known as the art director of I, and you've recently published issue 102. And the magazine first appeared in, 1990, founded by Rick Poyner. And you took over the art directorship from Nick Bell back in 2005. And in 2008, along with the editor John Walters, you bought the magazine from Haymarket Press. I think around about that time, it was when a lot of magazines and newspapers were losing readers and going online. So that seemed to be a pretty brave move to me. But now being the publisher, owner, art director, often writer, it's obviously has been a different dynamic. You've had to take on a lot more responsibilities in areas maybe that you are not so familiar with. I know you've been doing it for quite a while now, but how has that change settled with you? You seem to work there an awful lot. You know, whenever I contact you, you're always at it.
Well, I think magazines are capable of almost, you know, infinite. You're never quite sure when it's, well, it's never really done, is it? There's a deadline and the pages are sort of have to go somewhere. If you don't have a deadline, they're capable of infinite change. Not necessarily improvement, but certainly change. My history with I actually went back right to the beginning, because I was originally published by a magazine called Blueprint. I was the sort of design person for Blueprint. And Rick Poyner joined the staff of Blueprint to write. And he suggested, when Graphis magazine was sold to an American publisher.
Oh, you mean post Walter Herdick? You mean that period?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, Graphis, yeah. Which I guess was the sort of the accepted international graphic design magazine.
Absolutely. Yeah.
When Walter Herdick sold it, Rick said to Peter Murray, who was the sort of publisher of Blueprint, well, now there's room for an international design magazine now. I had a few conversations with Rick about I when he was sort of writing the document about what this magazine could be. So by the time it actually started to appear, I'd moved on from Blueprint. And so Stephen Coates was Blueprint's first art director. But I'd obviously followed it closely and was on the editorial at one period. And then it changed hands when, you know, Blueprint sold up effectively. It was owned by a couple of publishing companies that ended up at Haymarket. And I was talking to John Walters, the editor, one day, and he said, well, actually, Nick Bell's just resigned. I need to find a new art. And I said, well, maybe there's room for a guest art editor. So I was The studio was guest art editor for issue 64, and we still seem to be here, really.
Well, yes, that's 14 years on, isn't it?
Since it started.
What I'd like to do is metaphorically turn the pages back to see just how you arrived at this point in your life. So we're going to go back to the 10th of January 1958, when you were born, and you wouldn't have been very conscious, but at that time, top of the pop charts, Jerry Lee Lewis's Great Balls of Fire. The Beatles, as the Quarrymen, had made their first recording. The Russians launched Sputnik 1. The most successful film was David Lean's Bridge on the River Kwai. Harold Macmillan was the Prime Minister, just starting satire from the Cambridge University, the Footlight. You, with your family, lived in Chelmsford, Essex, and your dad was an electrical engineer, and your mother was an infant school teacher, and also, I think, involved with amateur dramatics, and she liked making costumes and games and toys. And you have a younger sister called Janet. What are your earliest memories of your childhood?
What are my earliest memories? I liked my cars, my little matchbox cars and my corgi cars. And
so you would have been what sort of age, Simon, now? Are we talking five years old?
Roughly that.
So were you becoming aware of things? Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, as you said, my father was an electrical engineer and he worked for a company called English Electric, which made the things he specialised in were valves and transmitters. And they were working with RCA, Radio Corporation of America, on joint projects. And he would go to California, to San Francisco, to visit their engineers and talk about the joint projects they were doing. That had started happening before I was born. So it was happening in the 54 or something. He was flying over there and he'd disappear, you know, he'd go for a week or two. And then there was one visit when I was about five, when my mother, who had a school friend who'd married an American soldier, she wanted to visit. And my father said, well, why don't we all go as a family? So my sister, Janet, was very young. I can remember the 707 that we flew on, the Pan Am 707 that we flew on. I can remember the free Pepsi on the plane. You just walked to the back of the plane and there was a Pepsi dispenser. And that was a revelation to me. Yeah. And then in America, I can remember, you know, big roads, big cars, although in fact, the family who we were staying with had what I guess would have been extremely trendy Volkswagen Beetle. They lived on a very steep hill in San Francisco. And of course, I was too young to appreciate that if I walked down the road, I'd probably be in Haight-Ashbury and could enjoy a whole other different lifestyle, I think. I remember quite a lot from that American journey because it was completely different.
So did that stimulate your visual world?
I'm not sure. It certainly made me think about, perhaps when I thought about America, I thought as much about San Francisco as that's the only place in America I'd visited, as the, you know, the more typical kind of at that point, you know, New York is the centre of stuff, really. Visual thing sort of started a bit later, which is that I think I first was interested in journalism.
How come?
So not so much design, but journalism.
How did that sort of manifest itself? Were you listening to a lot of radio broadcasts or reading a lot?
Reading a bit. We didn't have a daily paper at home, but we had the Sunday Times. And that ritual of the Sunday paper with its multiple sections, and I can remember the Colour magazine, which
Colour magazine would have started around when you were quite young,
around that time. Although, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it was going so Colour magazine, and you know, I can remember used to spend quite a lot of time sort of after school because my mother was a teacher. And we'd be waiting for her to finish teaching. And so sometimes I'd often go to my grandmother's, who was quite near my school, and my mother would come and collect me from my grandmother. So I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, who was quite left-wing, was into politics and a socialist. So she was a board member of the local Chelmsford Cooperative Society. You know, and so I can remember talking to her about the Vietnam War, and I can remember Gerald Scarfe's amazing drawings in the Sunday Times about the Vietnam War. I was interested at various stages in these kind of early years. I was interested in architecture. I don't know why, but I became, you know, interested in sort of modern architecture. And because of where I lived in Chelmsford, on the outskirts of Chelmsford, and family, friends, we knew quite a lot of farmers. So I was quite interested in sort of farming as well, and particularly farm machinery. So hence the sort of, you know, those Britons tractors and combine harvesters and
I do indeed
things that you could get.
I do. Yeah. I'll tell you just a little interjection, because I've not heard that name for years. The second commercial art studio I worked in as a, you know, dog's body, they produced the Britain's catalogue.
Oh, really?
And my job was to paste up all the little images that were photographed.
I think that's the kind of job I would have loved. And I still, when I go into toy shops buying things for, you know, friends, children, or whatever, I there are things that I think, gosh, I wish I'd... Gosh, those models are so much better than the models that I had when I was was young. I still have a kind of hankering after them, really. Yeah. So there was farming, there was architecture, there seemed to be journalism. And my grandmother was my co-conspirator in doing a little magazine that I had at primary school. She had a big old typewriter, you know, big, proper. You could use those type, if you disconnected the ribbon, to cut stencils for sort of Gestetner type machines. I don't know how I discovered all this. I think we must have one in the school office or something. Anyway, I started a magazine which was called Astronomy Chronicle, and it was consisted entirely of me saying things to my grandmother, who would type them, although obviously she would type them better than I, more intelligently than I said them. And you know, and you cut the stencil, and I think at first I sort of politely asked if I could have these printed on the duplicator at school. Mm-hmm. And then I think I saw in the local stationers, effectively a duplicator machine, but it wasn't one of these Gestetner type rotary things. It was flatbed. It was like a silkscreen. You attach the stencil to the screen with the tension of the ink, and you charged up your roller and lifted up the screen, put the paper underneath, put the screen down and rolled over the top, and a sort of inky black thing squidged through the stencil onto the paper below.
So that was your kind of first relationship with a printed piece of paper or whatever it was going to be used for.
Absolutely. And when I was primary school, and I very rapidly I'm always interested in the technology of printing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested in what those stencil machines could do. Fundamentally, you could type on them, but you could only really print in one colour. You could draw on the stencil as well, as if you put a certain kind of backing behind the stencil, you could draw on it in a very crude way. But then I discovered there were those spirit machines where you could do multiple colours. They work by you wrote over a sheet of kind of carbon paper, and they transferred the carbon onto the back of this piece of paper. And then you put it in the machine, which used a really foul-smelling and probably extremely dangerous fluid, which you rotated the drum, and the fluid carbon transferred because of the fluid onto the paper you were printing. And you could get a run of 25, 30 copies off it before the thing was exhausted.
So you were about 9 or something like that? Nine or ten.
And I also got my father to find out what machines, because I was doing this stuff, and he was saying, oh, we've got printing machines, meaning actually machines that do die lines, really. We've got a print room at the factory, because they were doing, you know, circuit diagrams and all sorts of things. And so mm-hmm. we tried out some of those, but I decided the blue line machine, well, not only was I think I was causing chaos at the English Electric print room, but I think it wasn't very good. So I was experimenting with all things. And I remember in the moon landing, right, 1969. So yeah. I was aged 11. I was just about to leave primary school. And I proposed that I was going to do an overnight edition of Astronomy Chronicle, which involved, my parents said, well, you better stay at your grandmother's then to do this, which is that I think my grandmother woke me up at sort of whatever time of the morning it would have been to watch the moon landing, which I think was about 5 o'clock in the morning or something. And then I proceeded to force her to type a front page, which I then printed. And then when I got to school at whatever it would have been, 9 o'clock or something, 9:30, I had the special edition of Astronomy Chronicle, which, like every other newspaper in the world, announced man had landed on the moon.
Oh, my goodness. So, it's all beginning to
I mean, we think we're talking about five or ten copies here. This is, we were not rivaling the Daily Express.
No, but the principle is interesting. The very fact that you, at such an early age, were making a piece of print to be read, you know, whether it's a broadsheet or a little church affair,
yeah.
It doesn't matter. It was still communicating. How interesting.
Well, there are two things about that. One is about news and what news is. Mm. And of course, I was merely repeating everything I'd heard on the television that morning. And it's about a deadline as well. And I am a sort of a deadline person, I think. Yeah.
So you're at junior school at this point. What other outside interests outside of school are you involved with?
I was quite good at athletics, running at school, but I refused to do the training and all the other things you were supposed to do. So I coasted for a few years being able to run, but of course, unlike one of my very good friends at school who would be out there practicing for, he was a long distance runner, would be out there practicing all the time, I never practiced. So I just got older and fatter and ceased to be able to win races.
I heard that you were in the Scouts, is that right?
I was in the Cubs.
In the Cubs, okay.
I was in the Cubs, and I liked the Cubs, and it was in the church hall over the road from the school. After Cubs, we'd go to the pub over. We were very young, so we'd go to the off license or the off sales bit of the pub over the road, and buy packets of crisps. Oh, yeah. I mean, no drink, alcoholic or otherwise, but just packets of crisps. And I always quite like that. But somehow the Scouts always seemed a little bit yomping across muddy land and up mountains and things like that. And I think I was a kind of a homebody kind of person. So I sort of did the Cubs, but never quite did the Scouts, really.
What other hobbies did you have outside of your newfound discovery of primitive printing machines and discovering that you could make more than one copy of things?
I think I had all those young boy things of the... I had construction sets. I was quite interested in those. I don't know if you remember, there were two kinds. There were ones that were little bricks and you mixed up a kind of flour and water, cement.
And Meccano, of course.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. So I would build houses from the brick thing, but I also had a sort of panel construction thing, which was a sort of, little did I know in its flimsiness, how like real panel upbuilding construction it was. You basically had sort of red plastic girders and you built this structure and the girders had little lugs on you could attach these very lightweight plastic panels to. I mean, it did look just like a 1960s Skidmore, Owings and Merrill building, only a bit smaller and without any services, you know. It was things like that. And then later I had a train set and I loved my train set. I was allowed to set it up on the... we had a very long Scandinavian side table bought from a very trendy shop in Colchester. And I was allowed to have the top for my train set. And, you know, you have your curving trains and your vehicles and your stations and your trees and all that kind of thing.
Were you interested in sports, that sort of thing?
No.
Pop stars?
No.
What did you have stuck on your walls in your bedroom?
I had... Do you remember those fantastic posters the Sunday Times used to do? Educational posters about things like the Roman Empire and things like... I had things like that.
Yeah.
And my parents were quite interested in design. My father was interested in good design. And my mother, she knew about fabrics and things like that. And my father was quite interested in... Because of what he did, he was quite interested in equipment. So we had a microwave cooker long, long, long before anybody else because my father microwaves what he worked with and he was just fascinated with what was this domestic use of this thing going to be like. So we had a microwave cooker and experiments would be made, but the microwave cooker had a DIY foil covering to it because my father said, actually, I'm not entirely convinced that it's totally...
safe.
you know, it's totally secure from the point of view of the rays. Yes. So, and we had a Moffat cooker bought from Heels because we would go up to London on the train, on the steam train, and we would go to, as a family, we'd go to places like Heels and we'd go to the design centre and things like that. And,
very sophisticated.
It was more about, my father was interested in things that worked properly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, well, this Moffat cooker is much better than, I think it was American, was it? And this is much better than all the other ones, and you can do this with the grill and the electricity. He might have persuaded my mother that to have an electric cooker, because he was an electrics man, you know, not a gas man. He was into electricity. You know, he went to university. He was a very smart boy. He was a scholarship boy. And he went to university. University was evacuated to Cambridge. King's College London was evacuated to Cambridge during the war. And so he spent his chunk of his King's College time actually in Cambridge. He believed in science and that, you know, now it's a kind of joke, isn't it? Harold Wilson and the white heat of technology and all that. My father, not in an overdone way, but he believed in the white heat of technology. He believed in science solving problems. And he was one of the scientists that was, well, he was involved in commercial electronics production. So he believed in all that stuff.
I think the last 2 years, we're talking about a different area of science. But yeah. I think everyone's view of scientists have changed enormously, quite rightly. Let's move on a little bit. You get to your 11 plus period and are then sent off to boarding school. I don't know whether sent off to boarding school is the right word, or you went to boarding school.
No, I think sent off is exactly the right word.
Okay. What do you mean? You protested? You didn't want to go?
I wasn't very keen on. The worry at the time was that the local grammar school, which was very good, was going to be changed and it might not be so good. And I passed the entrance exam to Brentwood School as a boarder. And I think my parents possibly thought I spent too much time with my Corgi cars and my construction set and not enough time with, you know, improving sports activity and things like that. So I went as a boarder to Brentwood and I was extremely homesick in my first couple of years in this sort of junior boarding house. I was really homesick and I used to come home, I could come home weekends. It
you
was like a 40 minute bus ride.
Exeat things, weekends.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I liked the school and I liked my friends, but it was a completely different kind of existence. So there was a sort of hobby room where people would basically make Airfix models. I wasn't very keen on Airfix models. Always those schools, there's a part of the community that's about sport. Mm. And I really wasn't not part of that community. And that became worse later on.
Did you find any creativity there? Did you find anything that sort of inspired you or started to set things alight a bit for you?
On a Sunday night, there was a film club. And so all the boarders would trudge over to the main hall where they got a projector and you could rent these films. Mm. It was a whole business sort of renting out. And we had a Sunday night film club. And I liked that. I was at that stage, I was, you know, watching a lot of films. And when I was at home, I'd stay up late on a Saturday night and watch the BBC Two movie, you know, The Fountainhead.
That architecture coming back into the frame.
Yeah. And in fact, later on at school, I used to do the leaflet for the film club and I got involved with programming the films as well. I spent a lot of time in the art room. You know, this was a public school. Art, a bit low on the agenda, something to be appreciated, but I loved the art room. And the art room had a big bookcase with back copies of the Architectural Review. Uh-huh. And I would go into the art room when I could and just sit there and read the Architectural Review and, you know, and its mixture of articles about contemporary architecture, contemporary modernist architecture, but also its historical articles. But also I loved the way it laid things out and the way it mixed papers and it had gatefolds and all sorts of expensive production things that general magazines didn't have. I think probably those copies of the Architectural Review were the first things.
That very magazine would rear its head again much later on. You left at what age? What happened after boarding school?
I stopped being a boarder after a while and became a day boy. You're travelling backwards and forwards and that was fine. And by that point, when I was particularly unhappy, my housemaster had said to me and my parents, by this point, I'd bought a little Adana 8.5 printing machine.
It's getting more and more like Citizen Kane.
I know. And this was because my uncle, my mother's brother, who was very involved with art and design and commercial television, we would go and see him quite a lot. And he was the person, they lived in London, and they had, you know, ladder rack shelving and things like that. And they shopped at Sainsbury's, so they had all that wonderful packaging.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a fondue set. You know, so he had an Adana 8.5 little printing machine for doing hobby stuff. And I'd seen it and become rather interested in it. So I bought, my father and mother bought me an Adana printing machine and some type. And when I was unhappy at boarding school, my housemaster said, well, we've got a cellar in the boarding house. Now, we didn't say it was a mouldy, dank cellar, but it was. And, you know, maybe Simon would like to bring his printing machine, his Adana printing machine, and he could do some printing in the cellar. This is very strange. Here was me, you know, whatever I was, 13 or something at this point, and I had a key to a dark and dank cellar of my own. In the boarding house, I had my little Adana down there, and I would print things.
Sounds rather like David Lint, who actually occupied part of the college he was at and sort of virtually took over a whole basement area, which is where
it wasn't quite a whole basement. And let's face it, nobody else wanted it. Because I remember I painted it snow sem or something.
Oh, yeah.
I used that to paint it white.
Yes.
And within a few weeks, paint was just falling off the wall because it was so damp.
Oh, dear, how awful.
But it was, hey, you know, it was somewhere I could go. And you know, friends would come down and help. And so by that stage, I was doing cards for school events and little notices. I mean, you know, an 8.5 means its platen is 8 inches by 5 inches,
yeah.
Right? So that's,
yeah.
you could print an A5 area in one go.
Mm.
And of course, if you printed it one way, then you turned it round, you could actually print a sheet of A4.
Mm. So you already had a little publishing empire going there. So my question at the beginning, which is how have you coped with, you've already been doing it since you're the age of 14.
Yes, I was still thinking of it much more as, you know, the journalism, the writing bit interested me. And
right.
I, you know, I'm not sure my graphic design at this point was not very sophisticated. I mean, we had the Graphis Annual and maybe Modern Publicity in the art room. And I'm sure I was the only person who ever looked at copies of Modern Publicity. My best friend at school at this age, Andrew, so the two of us were sort of doing things like, we did a form magazine on my little stencil duplicator called The Publication. But it became clear around this time was that, well, Andrew actually is a journalist. He works for The Times. You know,
how
so
funny.
I was the person I was judging myself against for my journalism qualities. It was really quite a high benchmark. And it saw what sort of happened, and it really developed with this being involved with the school magazine, was that I realised what I could do was take material, writing, photographs, and make it into something.
Mm.
And that really wasn't something that anybody else was very interested in doing. That's what I loved, you know. So I turned the school magazine from kind of A5-ish, basically single column thing. I turned it into with the help of the master who was in charge of the school magazine. You know, we made it a sort of quarto format, which meant it could be double column, and we could start having big pictures and things like that.
I remember myself an amazing moment when I was at evening classes and I was doing calligraphy and illuminated lettering. That was all I could get into because all the other courses had gone. But anyway, I loved it. In the break, I would go to the library and, like you, found all of these books that I'd never seen before in my life called Gebrauch Graphik and...
Yeah.
You know, Modern Publicities, and I found Muller Brockman's book, you know, and I looked through and suddenly a bell sort of rang in my head, and I looked at it and I thought, there's an actual job where you can deal with image, space and typography and make it look incredibly interesting. And that for me became my kind of, you know, directional thing.
Exactly the same experience. And, you know, we had a couple of budding photographers at school, and we used the local printer called Minerva Press to print the school magazine, letterpress, of course, on a single colour Heidelberg cylinder, although I wouldn't have known any of those words at the time. But what I did very rapidly, I had a thing about the difference between Univers and Helvetica.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that was probably my first real typographic education, was that you could get Univers in the Adana catalogue, but the typeface I realised I really loved was Helvetica. I'd see it on, you know, things. And it was about what the difference was that kind of fascinated me. So we couldn't get Helvetica for the school magazine, but we could get Univers if I could persuade the guy who ran the printer to rent the matrices from Monotype, which he did. I don't think he'd ever done it before, but he said, "Oh, we can get it." But, you know, so I did the school magazine, and I think it, and that was my, you know, my first proper magazine and my first magazine over budget. And I think I was probably the only pupil who was ever summoned to see the school bursar, who didn't normally ever talk to pupils. And he was a very nice ex-military chap who said, "Well, I've just had the bill in for the school magazine, and it's, I'm just interested to know why it costs twice as much as it used to." And I said, "Well, you know, I think we're trying to do some very interesting things here graphically." And he sort of said, yes, but I think maybe we can, you know, maybe we can talk about the costs of the next issue before we actually incur them.
I think your credentials for what you went on to do later are very well founded. So let's move on a bit. So after boarding school, what happened then?
My A-levels were a total disaster, and I've never quite understood why. So ostensibly, I did English and I did history and I did politics, and I was supposed to go to Warwick and study PPE, politics, philosophy, economics. I had a place at Warwick as long as I got my, whatever it was, 1A and 2Bs or something like that. And somehow in that period when I was doing my A-levels, I had a terrible habit of when somebody said, "Oh, just read this, you just have to read this chapter of the history book, this bit about the Napoleonic Wars, just read that bit." But I didn't ever do that. I wanted to read the whole book because I thought it was interesting and, you know, context and all that stuff. So I was hopeless at my reading, my stuff. And I started, I just messed up my A-levels.
What did that mean?
Not going to Warwick to study PPE, not even going to Kent, which was my second choice to study history, possibly. What it meant was sitting down in one of those sort of rather 19th century conversations with your father. You know, he was very good about the fact I wasn't going to be a scientist, which I think is what he would have sort of liked. But that wasn't ever a problem. He understood that I was interested in design. There was never any suggestion that I was going to go to art school. I don't think I knew art school existed. When I became interested in printing, what my secondary school suggested was that I should go to the LCP and study print management. I had a very nice chat with somebody who'd been to the LCP and studied print management. He's an alumni of the school. I just said, "Actually, I don't want to study print management. What I actually want to do is you know, make these things. I want to design these things." I saw a job advertised at one of the first of the instant print shops in the UK, and it was advertised somewhere odd, like Campaign. But the key thing was, this was a non-union print shop. This was a non-union. And so what they were looking for was either, you know, young, smart people who could be the public face of the print shop, or old lag printers who were quite happy not being a member of the union. We had two branches. We had a branch in Shepherd's Market.
Where was this? What was the company?
It's called Letterstream.
Didn't they make badges and things like that?
Yes, we did. We worked with a guy called Jolly, who, before he made enough money to get his own printing machine, we printed the badges and made them up for him. Jolly would turn up on a Friday night with what I then learned. I mean, I had a very innocent childhood, right? Would then proceed to roll, was then described to me as a joint, and start smoking and doing the artwork for his badges. I was actually quite a good art worker, and I was appalled at the standard of his artwork. And he would occasionally say, "Oh, come on, Simon, do some badges." Jolly was great friends with the guy who managed the Shepherd's Market branch, which was the slightly more youthful branch. Shepherd's Market was this amazing little community in Mayfair.
It's where all the prostitutes used to hang out.
Yes, there were the prostitutes.
I've worked in Queen Street, Mayfair, so I know that little area very well.
You know, here was me. I was still going backwards and forwards at this point to Chelmsford. I was living with my parents. Catch an early train.
Yeah.
And if I was lucky, I'd catch a late train back. Sometimes if I was working too much, I'd sleep on the floor in the studio. But we had the prostitutes, we had the sort of slightly shady characters who inhabited the pubs. There was a guy whose surname was Guinness, but he wasn't one of the Guinness family, but he used that to con people out of money. There were all the people that ran all the sort of coffee shops. Mm. Stirling Moss lived up the road. We'd occasionally see Stirling Moss.
It was a very wealthy area outside of Shepherd's Market, which was had a more of a seedy feel, but there were film directors and all sorts of people in that area.
What would happen in our branch was that people would drop in and they'd be investors or people who ran what we would now call startups, you know, small companies, little offices, but a Mayfair address. They'd be dealing with the Gulf, or they'd be dealing in oil, or they'd be dealing in equipment, or they'd be film directors. And they'd come in and they'd say, oh, I need a letterhead for my new company. And you'd take the details and, you know, it would be 500 sheets of A4 and some envelopes, and they'd want it. They want to see a proof the next day, and then they'd want it printed. And we had a bunch of rotoprint machines downstairs to print them. And either we'd do the artwork, or we had IBM composing machines, or we'd letraset it, reduce it down, paste it up, make a plate. Or if there really was a budget, and there hardly ever was a budget, I was allowed to phone Face or Conway's.
Oh yeah, and get
some photo setting.
But yes.
That was a very rare occasion.
I remember you order close spacing, not touching.
Close not touching as off.
Yes.
Because that way you've just got a line of type, and then you use your own process camera to make it bigger and smaller and all those kinds of things. We could barely afford get Face to set four words, you know. And I love the idea that we use Conway's as well. You'd be sitting in the shop. Van from Conway's would arrive at 8:30 in the morning, and there'd be a little plastic bag with your typesetting.
And they also had a wonderful poster showing all different printing techniques, mezzo tinting and things like that. You thought, that looks fantastic.
Just that whole idea that there was an overnight typesetting and printing world to do with advertising and newspapers.
Yes.
And when I needed monotype typesetting done for odd things, I would use a company called Studio Typesetting.
Me too.
Sutton Street.
Yes, I used
because
them.
I'd got their poster and I thought that was the coolest poster ever. And it was slightly odd relationship because I would send them stuff and they would typeset it and I'd ask for the type. So they'd wrap the type up, stick it on Red Star and send it back to me.
That's an old.
But my mother had to write the check because I didn't have a checkbook or indeed a bank account. But I was fascinated by this world. So
so how long were you at Letterstream?
I was at Letterstream for a couple of years, letter-setting away furiously.
Mm-hmm. And you moved on next.
Family-owned company. Owned by two families. We had the Architects Journal, very functional magazine, virtually every architect in the country at this point. I mean, we're talking about 1978. Virtually every architect in the country got. And the Architectural Review, the monthly, different floor, much classier production. I mean, the old sort of joke was that the Architects Journal made the money and the Architectural Review spent the money. That was the sort of feeling of the building. We also owned the Architectural Press, which was a book publisher. So on the upper floor, it was in 3-4 Georgian buildings in Queen Anne's Gate. And on the Journal was on the first floor. The Review was on the second floor. And we had publishing on the third floor, and then accounts and advertising in the attic. That was the structure. I think I was probably the only candidate. This was to be the assistant art editor of the Architects Journal. And I think I was probably the only candidate who knew what a floor plan was.
So at this time you were really quite young, because everyone else would have been at uni, I assume.
Exactly. I was 19 or 20.
You were kind of ahead of the game, really.
Well, I was incredibly innocent and I hadn't been to university and I'd never been taught anything about design.
You had knowledge that perhaps the others wouldn't have had.
Yeah, I had a certain kind of knowledge, and I liked architecture very much. And they'd recently employed a production editor called Janet Pearson, who'd worked at the Radio Times and at Design Magazine, which is a magazine I'd actually subscribed to when I was at school. And I think possibly it was that in the interview I said, well, I used to be a subscriber. And I think they hired me anyway. And Janet was very protective towards me. And Colin, who was the art editor, who wasn't much older than me. And I was there for about a year or so. And Colin Jenkins went off to work for Now magazine. Do you remember Now magazine?
Indeed,
James Goldsmith's thing?
Yeah.
Because he was a good designer. He was a good magazine designer and they were hiring. And Colin went off. And so I was about 20-ish. And there was a discussion, which was, do we have to hire an art editor for the Architects Journal? Or do we make Simon the art editor of the Architects Journal and get him an assistant? And I think Janet was quite decent about it. And Janet and a couple of the editors I got on quite well with said, well, why don't you give Simon a chance? So I was 20 years old and I was running a weekly magazine that had 120 editorial pages a week. You know, it didn't have, it had a format, quite a clever format, but I was, yeah, I was in charge.
So were you commissioning? Did you begin to commission photography or any external graphic work?
Most of the graphics were architect's drawings, and we had a drawings editor, and the drawings for the buildings we were featuring would go through the drawings editor, who had sat on a big drawing board next door with the sub-editors, correcting drawings and doing new drawings. And these were vast things.
Yes, I can imagine.
Vast rolls, and you had to send them off to the printers to be photographed. I was very lucky that the buildings editor, who controlled the sort of 16 feature pages of the magazine, was a really nice He's a very nice guy called Patrick Hannay. And he would talk to me about what buildings he was doing and what would we do. And I'd got to know two up-and-coming architectural photographers. There was a guy called Richard Bryant, and there was a guy called Martin Charles. And they were very different, but they would bring their work in, the jobs they'd shot for us. This was a period when the magazine could still afford to commission photography in the UK, as opposed to change the way architectural photography works now. But they would bring the work in, and Patrick would say, oh, come and, you know, Martin's bringing the pictures of such and such in, come and see them. And Martin, these would be contact prints, and Martin, whose father was an architect, and who'd in fact been a film editor, who decided to become a photographer. And Martin, if you asked him to do a building, he'd go and see it, so that he knew what time of day was going to be the best light because of the building's aspect. And he was a classic, he had a large format, 5 inches by 8 inch plate camera, which he used like a 35 millimeter. I mean, he just, you know, put the classic black hood over his head, exposed a plate, did something, moved on to another one. I mean, you know, none of this sort of large format preciousness that one got slightly used to later on. I mean, he really, and he was an amazing guy. And I'd go on odd shoots with him. So in that sense, Martin and Richard, I wasn't really commissioning, but I'd be working with Patrick about which photographer we would use. And then I started, in my little time of subscribing to Design Magazine, I'd rather like the work of this photographer called Philip Sayer.
Yes, because it was kind of old Philip.
It was quite black and white and quite strong, and he did great portraits. And so one day when we had a fairly ordinary story about a housing association conversion, you know, this was not heroic architecture. It was not going to make heroic architectural pictures in that way.
Yeah.
I said, well, why don't we ask Philip Sayer to do something? And this was about 1978. And Philip went and did a fantastic set of pictures, and he'd bring in the prints. This is all black and white. And Philip's the only thing he said to me was, there's just one thing here, right? Don't crop my pictures.
If I'm right, did he not work alongside or with Nick Broomfield's dad, the...
Yes.
Industrial photographer.
Maurice Broomfield.
Maurice, yes.
He was an assistant to Maurice Broomfield. I mean, Maurice Broomfield, who I discovered about later, much later, you know, was a large format guy doing industrial photography in the sort of German mode.
With incredible lighting as well.
The lighting is what, you know, what made it. And but Phil had gone to work in a darkroom in Wardour Street, and he'd worked there for a long time as a printer and then started doing photography. So his black and white prints were amazing. They are still the most wonderful.
Because he did all the hand
I've ever seen.
All the hand
They were hand printing, dodging.
Yeah.
He didn't show you, Phil didn't show you a contact sheet.
No.
He chose the pictures that he wanted to print.
I think he's photographed just about everyone. And he has such an affinity with, he did a lot for Crafts magazine, I think.
Yes,
many years ago, and he had such an affinity with artists, I think. He really sort of made them look interesting and created an atmosphere about them that you wanted to be like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Phil did a job for me last week. I mean, we've worked together on and off in different ways since 1978, you know.
In fact, you've kept connections with many of the people you've worked with for a couple of decades, haven't you?
Well,
you sort of...
Yeah, I mean, it's not that it's a fixed thing.
There's a chemistry, there's an understanding, you don't have to overly tell people what you need.
Well, I'm not really a designer, and I'm not really an art director. And my idea of art direction is actually about choosing the right person and making who I think is the right person and getting them access. So
Pick you up on something you just said. You're not a designer. Come on, you are a designer, for God's sake.
I'm surrounded by, there are so many people better than me. I think I'm quite a good organizer, quite a good catalyst for things. So with people I work with, whether it's the repro houses or printers or photographers or illustrators, creators or other designers I work with.
We should wind on a little bit to...
Okay.
You're now confident. You're actually acting in the role of art editor or director, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it. And then you move on to Peter Murray's publications, his outfit.
Yes.
Where Blueprint is in the offing. You talked a little bit about that earlier. So just tell me the transition between the architectural press and moving on. How did that occur?
Blueprint was started as a monthly magazine, large format, tried to talk about architecture, interior design, products, and graphic design as though it was one subject, and it wasn't sort of ghettoized into an architecture magazine and separate topics. And it started, we would get together once a month and make it. We'd very kindly been lent studio space by Manali Tattersfield. Everybody worked for nothing. There was a tax scheme which meant people could invest in a business and get some kind of tax offset. And so Peter persuaded people like Terence Conran and Rodney Fitch and Zeev Aram to invest. And it started, I was still working at the Architectural Press. Dan Sujic had been at the Architectural Press and left just as I joined and was architecture editor of the Sunday Times. Peter Murray was publisher at the RIBA Journal. And we went to our respective employers and said, look, we're just doing this little thing, right? It's a little idea. Are you uncomfortable about this? Do you feel this is competitive? And I went to the editor of the Architecture Journal and said this, and they said no, it's fine. And that was fine for about 9 months to a year, when one day the publishing director of the Architectural Press came to the art room and said, Simon, I just think, you know, Blueprint's selling advertising and they're selling more advertising than we are. I think, Simon, you might need to make a choice between the Architects Journal and Blueprint. And foolhardy, I said, okay, Blueprint then. Thank you. Bye-bye. It's been nice.
Well, it was a good decision. I mean, it was the magazine, I remember, when it first sort of appeared in this large colour format. Very strong typography. It was...
Well, where had I seen it? Sorry, just to backtrack very slightly. Because I didn't go to art school and because you learnt stuff in little bits, didn't you?
Yeah.
I learnt things in little bits. Basically, you copy.
I think you do what I think... Laurence Olivier said about acting, you pick on somebody you like, you copy them, and you keep copying them until it becomes your own, and then suddenly you're your own person.
Exactly.
I think that does happen.
So the people that whose work I'd seen and liked and knew about were the three Davids.
Yeah, David King David would
Driver,
be one of them, wouldn't he?
At the Radio Times.
Yeah.
David Hillman,
yeah,
at various Pentagram. He was at Pentagram at this point.
Yeah.
And David King.
Of course, David King. And I always relate you more to David King, I think, than any of the earlier ones.
Yeah, well, I love David's approach. I like that career from the Sunday Times to other things.
Yes.
And I love that sort of heavy rule stuff.
Yes.
And which he did better than anybody else,
absolutely.
I think.
Absolutely.
And so when we started Blueprint, it was large format and, you know, we had Letraset and we had a process camera and we would just, you know, fill the page with type when there wasn't any copy or a good picture.
Well, it was a big format to play like that, wasn't it? It wasn't like it was a piddling format. It was really big.
You know, we were very lucky. Phil and other photographers would work for us for nothing. We had a kind of, you know, there was Diane going around the world, finding things and bringing the transparencies back. We had a very good writer in America called Jan Abrams, who knew all the up-and-coming architects. And people, even some of the big practices, like the fact double-page spread photograph of your building or your product in Blueprint was bigger than you were going to get anywhere else, you know. So that was great. Initially, I'd been offered a job on the UK launch of Elle by Clive Crook. The idea was that I was going to work 4 days a week at Elle and one day at Blueprint.
My goodness.
But I'm afraid, I'm not really a fashion person, and I actually like Clive Crook and Debbie and the team that were doing Elle. But, you know, so slow. I just found it, there were two things. I found it very slow in a big art room, and also the fashion well was under the control of the fashion editors.
And they are so fickle in what they want and what they don't want. And you end up being a toy, I think. I mean, that's pretty obvious. with a lot of magazines. Yeah. And then, of course, every other page is punctuated by a huge advertisement. You don't get any sense of flow.
Sure. So even Clive, I think, struggled to get the get control of the fashion well. Yes, so I was basically doing sort of features on, you might have an opening spread and then three singles. And it would be a decent, you know, I was doing the tougher sort of features. But I just found it, by comparison with Blueprint, where, you know, we would make a magazine over a weekend. You know, we'd organise the typesetting beforehand, but we'd arrive on Saturday morning and Diane and myself and a couple of people who were working with me and some of the writers, we'd all get together and there'd be discussion of what we got, and then everybody would go for lunch and then they'd go and myself and the art team would then work all night to make a magazine.
Yeah, I think if you are, you know, brought up in that way, i.e. starting very young, you actually do gain the ability to be able to do things and end up being able to do a lot of things fast. And then you find that everybody else is actually quite slow.
I think, yeah, I mean, you know,
and I think you retain that all your life. I mean, I work in a similar way in publishing, where I was doing everything. I was designing, doing the art direction, pacing it, everything. And I could do it very fast. And then, of course, as years go by and you realise how everybody else seems to be very slow.
It's partly if you're doing it by yourself, you don't waste a lot of time permission or getting agreements about things.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think it's like flying hours, you know. You put in the hours, and I've put in so many hours doing paste up, letter setting and text corrections. And
let's move away from paste all that now. You were established very much so with Blueprint. I mean, it got a lot of accolades and became the magazine that everyone had, whether you were a graphic designer, architect or whatever. We all took that magazine. You moved on, didn't you, to other things. Was this freelance? Obviously, you were involved with the Guardian newspaper. I don't mean the first incarnation, but the other one for quite some time. And then Domus, you art directed that, which is an incredible magazine too.
I had a desk space at Blueprint. I didn't realise at the time what a benefit that was. And Blueprint is always bubbling along, but essentially it only took a week to do an issue. So I would do freelance, and I consulted with the launch of the London Daily News and got a sort of taste for newspapers there. And then Blueprint started a property business called Word Search.
Doing
property brochures. And I mean, I was, obviously, I was the designer, and I was very influenced by things that Massimo Vignelli was doing for Harry Macklow in New York, which I think Dan had brought one back and said, have you ever seen anything like this? And they were amazing. And property brochures in the UK were made by B-team advertising agencies, basically, at this point. And then the property market started to take off, and we started doing brochures, and other people did. You probably did brochures, and Carter Chavin did brochures, and suddenly brochures were a thing that design companies were asked to do. And the problem was that the brochure business, ourselves and SOM, won this property developer who basically had a mobile phone. That was his only, he didn't even have an office, he had a mobile phone. But he hired Skidmore, Owings and Merrill to do the competition presentation to take over City Hall, GLC building. And we worked with Skidmore, Owings and Merrill. Word Search Blueprint had worked with Skidmore, Owings and Merrill on another project. And SOM said, well, no, we want you to do the offer document. And the offer document was three case-bound books, fully printed in a slipcase, with illustrations done by the world's leading architectural illustrator, graphics, presentations, the five copies, right? Just our bit, the production and printing of this set of three documents was £100,000.
My God.
But he won the competition. Millions and millions of pounds. So this was the sort of spirit of the times, was that people spending money on brochures where the, you know, the cost wasn't particularly important relative to the building. And I'm afraid that became so overwhelming as a business for us. I didn't really ever get a chance to do Blueprint properly. So I was introduced to a designer, art director called Mike Lackerstein, who was doing...
He was at Redwood, wasn't he? Redwood Publishing?
He was design director at Redwood.
They were doing lots of in-house magazines.
Mike was getting slightly fed up with doing lots and lots and lots of things and not being able to... He's a brilliant art director and typographer, and he was being pulled away from that. And we sort of talked a bit, and there wasn't really... Apart from David Hillman at Pentagram, there wasn't really anybody who special... I mean, I know you at CDT did... editorial design, but you were doing other things as well. There wasn't really an agency that just did editorial design. And that's what we wanted to do. We started, we had a very brief period with three partners, but essentially it was Esterson Lackerstein, Mike and I, and a couple of designers.
And you were doing a quite a big range magazines, weren't you, at the time? I think you did a lot for the arts world, did you not?
Well, I was doing the Royal Academy Friends magazine, which I'd done for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Mike was doing, Mike did some partwork stuff for The Observer. Mike did the cover for Marxism Today and did a sort of redesigned format for The Inside. The big thing that happened to us, this was the first proper business I'd ever been involved with. It had all otherwise been all freelance. And so, we were told we had to have a bank manager. So we found a very nice bank manager and we made a business plan, went to several meetings and went through the business plan with him about our turnover and all, of course, complete figment of our imagination. And then we got a call from the Sunday Telegraph, who wanted a new larger format magazine supplement because they didn't have much colour printing capacity. So they wanted to make a section that could take colour ads and do other things. And we got that job. And that job was our year's imaginary turnover in the first 2 weeks of our existence, really. And that was really the pattern. You know, we would do small magazines that couldn't really afford art departments but wanted.
How long did that relationship last?
With Mike?
Yeah.
10, 12 years?
And were you at, did you eventually end up in Hoxton Square still?
Yes, we did.
With Mike before you.
We started off in Cramer Street on the floor beneath Blueprint. Then we went just off Kingsland Road in Tim Simmons, the photographer, had a studio in Kingsland. Yeah. And he didn't want the studio, and Mike knew him very well. So we were there for a bit. And then we moved to Hoxton Square. And, I mean, Mike was incredibly tolerant of me because I was younger, not particularly well organised. The idea of working all night on a presentation was rather familiar to me. And Mike was grown up. he had another life outside work and was very organised. And he put up with me for, 12 years or something.
That's a long time.
Including me announcing that I had coffee with the editor of The Guardian last night and I was going to be The Guardian's sort of consultant art director, which I have to say, in my enthusiasm for the project, I accepted before I told Mike. Extremely badly behaved. So, and eventually, sadly, didn't really work out anymore. Decided to go our separate ways.
Well, you were kind of now motoring because, you know, the work that you did at The Guardian. Who were you working there with?
What happened was Alan Rusbridger arrived as editor. And through very kind recommendations, he was looking. Alan liked the work that Hillman had done, which would be about eight years previously, but recognised that it was beginning to, like all these things, the building was suffering from a lack of maintenance. Things were happening that weren't in the original Hillman brief or the original Hillman proposals. But I think he wanted somebody he could basically talk to all the time. I don't think was the relationship you could have with a Pentagram partner at that point. So he phoned me up and said, can I talk to you about who should be the art director of The Guardian? Not a job that actually existed to that point. And I saw Alan and Georgina Henry and we talked about various people, you know, this person in Scotland, this person I knew at the Sunday Times, this person who I thought was interesting in magazines. And we had a very nice conversation. And of course, I was a Guardian reader and stuff. And Alan rang me up the next morning and said, well, actually, why don't you have the job? And I said, well, you know, I've got a studio here and business and stuff. And he said, well, it doesn't have to be full time. Why don't you just do it half time? I think when you have the editor of The Guardian on the phone with a really exciting offer, I said yes.
Yeah.
Then I had to explain to everybody else sort of what I'd agreed to, really.
We're kind of almost arriving at where we are now. I mean, you're very familiar with all those years that you spent with I, slaving away. We don't know one another very well, but I've always sensed a couple of things about you that I'm pretty certain you work bloody hard. I think you're probably completely dedicated to I magazine because, you know, just conversations I've had with you, I know that you put so much effort into wanting to ensure that the quality of the magazine is as good as it can possibly be. And that starts with not only the what's going to go into it, but how it's going to look on the page. And so all those things that quite often magazines don't care about, the quality of the repro and the scanning and all that stuff is very closely, but it all takes a lot of time.
Well, I think that you talked earlier about people that I've worked with over quite long periods. And, you know, for me, it's like a kind of repertory company. Well, this is the right printer for this job. This is the right photographer. And you're building on a relationship. So, you know, I've worked with, it used to be called Precise Litho, and now it's called Dawkins Colour, but John Bodkin at Dawkins Colour, I've also worked with probably for more than 40 years. And we've been through old-fashioned scanning technology and digital technology and all those things together. Mm-hmm. And I do, because I've done different kinds of projects, I like the technology, I like the differences in the technology. And let's face it, if we're going to have a John Walters and I, you know, because we own Eye, we want to make the best magazine we can possibly make between each other. And he's a brilliant editor and commissioning writer and commissioning editor. And I think we sort of complement each other. John has views about design, which is fine. And he tolerates my views about editing, you know.
You occasionally write, don't you, as well?
I write a bit.
Number of...
Yeah. And I, you know, my early experience of discovering that I was not a good writer as Andrew Billen, I like editing. I like that shaping business. But actually sitting down and writing, I find quite painful. And so I've done a few things recently where I do interviews, a bit like this, and then I transcribe them. And I find that quite interesting because it's less painful for me as a piece of writing. And, you know, I can frame the discussion and then frame the answers so that, you know, that editing thing that I like.
And, of course, the magazine itself, because you have a lot of connections now with a lot of type companies and paper merchants and so forth, you do bring that very much into the magazine. Different papers, you know, different quality printing all the way through. So everyone is slightly different. So the production side is quite complex.
Yeah, the different paper thing goes right back to those days with the Architectural Review in the art room at school. They used different papers, coated, uncoated, coloured, gatefolds, all sorts of those things, which I love. But there are very few magazines in the world that still want to work that way.
You also produce a lovely little magazine called Pulp for Fedrigoni, I think it is, isn't it? Italian paper company, which I've got a couple of copies, actually. And it's almost like a mini version of I, in that got here is a feature on Unit Editions. Terrific story about them. And then followed by, you know, all the things that anyone with an eye for design or photography or, you know, just a visual world or even interiors. It's a lovely little magazine that is so beautifully put together.
So the subheading is, you know, a magazine about people and paper. I mean, Fedrigoni are absolutely fantastic client, but a paper company is an amazing client because what they want is good things, interesting things, beautiful things, startling things on their paper.
Yes, and that's great because you can push to see just how far you can go with their paper. So everyone wins if you can show that their paper is fantastic, even if it's the most absorbent you can imagine, but still somehow you can make it look really special.
And it's, I mean, we published the magazine in a number of languages. Fedrigoni, being Italian, have got a commitment printing in Italy, so it's become a sort of marvellous journey for me. We changed the printer pretty much every year because they don't want to offend all their Italian printing clients. So I pass every issue. I missed one issue during COVID. Issue 22 has just finished at the bindery.
Right.
So I've seen 21 issues.
My goodness.
It's like three issues a year. And I've probably seen the inside of more Italian printing companies than I have English printing companies in a way.
Do you still have to have that awful waiting when, you know, when you're doing passes, you have to, something goes wrong and you've got to wait for an hour in a little room with a cup of coffee?
Yeah, but now you've got a laptop. I just work on Dropbox between the press passes. I mean, they are very, you know, you get to learn a lot about the way different companies operate. And we've had a few issues with some. But on the other hand, one of the Italian printers, one of the biggest book printers in Italy, I actually thought were fantastic to work with. And we're now, although I'm a great fan of English printers, and, you know, there's a couple of English printers that I have worked with regularly for years and years. I think at the moment we're printed with, if they're not the best, in my view, the best book printers in Europe. They're certainly in that top five book printers in Europe. And they sort of tolerate us because, although we're not a big catalogue and book like they normally do, they quite like the challenges of different papers and double-hit silvers.
Yeah, it must be a very good calling card for them, particularly to design firms who are putting print out. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's really showing what can be done.
I've always thought that printing, like repro, was part of the creative process, you know.
It is, and, yeah, I agree.
Know, printing now is very, very good, and the range of options from digital to light, you know, all those things are interesting. But, and you can have two different factories, they've both got the same machines, same inks, the same plates, but you can get an average job from one of them, which would be good these days, very good. It'll be in register, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the other printer will do an amazing job, and I think you can see it on the page myself.
Yes, I agree. I just want to sort of round up now.
Sure.
Because having the magazine is one thing and getting the readers is one thing, but I think you've put quite a lot of energy into, you know, general engagement with your readers via your website, which I think you said yourself felt was very important when you took over
yes.
the magazine.
Yes.
You had work in a parallel world, the digital world, and you're doing yes. a print thing, a physical object. And so you I think you do quite a lot of what I don't know whether it's a lot, but you do often connect up with outside organisations like St Bride Printing Library or Mag Culture to have mm-hmm. little talks and mm-hmm. presentations. Has that proved successful?
Well, I hope so. When you make what's supposed to be a quarterly magazine, but we actually struggle to make 4 issues a year, you need to keep reminding people you exist.
Yes.
And also St Bride and Mag Culture exemplify two directions that we need to keep in mind. I am fascinated by history. I'm still that person who did history at school, and I have learnt, I think, a reasonable amount about design history and printing history over the years, and that, you know, that leads to my sort of passion and advocacy for St Bride's. But on the other hand, I think can't make a magazine that's just about history. You've got to balance it with some conversation about what's going on. I think Jeremy's done an amazing job with Mag Culture of kind of identifying that area of independent magazine makers, promoting it and talking about it. And, you know, those makers they're like us, but they're also, some of them are our readers, because that's part of our audience.
Do you know what your demographic it is? I mean, it's mostly young designers, do you think? Because whenever I pass Mag Culture and there's one of those little talks, everyone looks about 18.
Well, I think Mag Culture's demographic is probably younger than I's demographic. I mean, we're quite geographically spread. So, you know, after the UK, the circulation, the sales are, you know, America, Holland, Switzerland, but in Germany, then yeah. out to Australia and Canada and things. So that's what you'd expect, isn't it? That's an English-speaking,
yes.
you know, kind of expensive magazine footprint. And the thing about the lockdown has suddenly meant that those things which we, as talks at St Bride's, became Zoom events.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did a Zoom about Milton Glaser when he died, and almost everybody was talking from the United States. That was an event we couldn't possibly have conceived of before.
Are you going to continue to do Zoom events, even though
yeah.
I mean, it seems that a lot of people have latched onto Zoom out of necessity, but found actually it's rather better at doing certain things. Have more people.
Provided you get your time zone sorted out.
Everyone can join in.
Exactly. It leaps across that, which is fantastic. I mean,
yeah.
you know, conferences. You remember conferences where you had to, you know, work out who could sponsor, who you could afford flying in.
I know.
That famous American art director. And, you know, the occasion when you phone that famous American art director who says, oh, actually, you know, I'd like my partner to come too. And I only have a travel business class. And you think, oh, yes, you are an American art director,
yeah.
aren't you? Well, Zoom solves those problems.
Well, look, now, last question. I always ask the same question at the end. And it's about having some pearls of wisdom for any young designers wanting
sure.
to kind of follow in your footsteps. Now, probably young designers are
I'm following in their footsteps, I think.
Well, they're already at uni, so you're way ahead of them. So what would you say to anyone? Because it's a tough business now, I think. There's so many.
If you love printed things, that's great. But you're going to need to be able to do digital things too, because that's the world. And, you know, obviously at a certain point in my life, I decided, probably because I'd been doing printed things for too long, that although the web was interesting and online is interesting, I wasn't going to shift my focus. And we do digital stuff, and we're interested in digital stuff. But I feel very much a beginner when I sit in digital conversations and briefs and things, and I rely on the people around me who help me. That's what I'd say. I'd also say it's a much more a magazine question, isn't it? For me, it's not about initially about a typeface or a page size or something. It's about content. And for me, I begin with the content of something, or the possible content, or the way the content could be arranged. And that, for me, is just a key part of when I start thinking about how we then do something. I mean, sometimes you don't have a lot of freedom.
I think probably that's a very good piece of advice, because I think probably a lot of people just don't think about content like that. They're thinking about, I'll do a nice illustration, or I'll do a nice bit of typography. But the component parts, which will ultimately make up the page or a run of spreads, is the thing that you have to see how they relate to each other and what sort of rhythm you'll get. And so that's a whole different sort of thought process, isn't it?
That's your raw material.
Yeah.
Or you will make it to be your raw material. So for me, that begins the thing that I engage with. Is it Derek Birdsall, the famous quote, read the copy, and then read the copy again?
Sounds like Derek. With a cigarette, of course, at the same time.
Of course, yes.
Oh, well, look, Simon Esterson, thank you very much for sharing your RDI insights. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for asking me.